Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 119 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. My job is try to keep some other airplane geeks under control for the next 90 minutes or so. First, and the co-host with perhaps the most self-control is David Vanderhoof, our resident historian and military aviation expert. Hi, David.
I'm not sure if that's a compliment or an insult. Hi, Max. Hi, everyone.
Glad to have you back. Also, we have Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog. He often appears under control, but I think there's a wild man just lurking under the surface waiting to burst out. Hi, Rob.
That's really true. In fact, in this week, I'm bursting out in Atlanta at the National Business Aviation Association show. And I knew when you were talking about the person with the most self-control, I thought, if you pick me, then you have not been on the same show with me for the last year.
So. Yeah, I've been listening.
Well, welcome to everybody.
Also tonight, the seemingly uncontrollable Dan Webb from the Things in the Sky blog will be joining us in a bit. So to compensate for his late arrival, we have Gavin Werbeloff again. Gavin may or may not be much more controllable than Dan, but he's here with us tonight. Hi, Gavin.
How are you guys doing?
Great. Glad you could join us. I know Gavin's got a little bit of a challenge in terms of getting connected, but I think we'll be able to figure it out as we go along.
Hey, Gavin, let me hear you say a couple of times. Yeah, I think he still does it better than Dan.
Better than Dan. Okay.
You know, I feel like we should get a pre-recording and then harmonize the ums. So when Dan gets into a really long we throw in the pitch adjusted one, and it, you know, creates a nice soothing sound.
All right, it sounds like a plan.
Sort of a chant.
Exactly.
Yes. In fact, you guys would be happy to see, we were sitting on the ramp at Peachtree DeKalb yesterday, and this Gulfstream 550 taxis in, and everybody said, oh, you know, who's on that airplane? And I said, no. And they said it was the Dalai Lama.
Honest
to God, yeah. And there was an entourage waiting for him. I mean, there must have been 15 cars waiting for him at signature to pick up the Dalai Lama.
Wow.
He is actually on the faculty of Emory University.
Is he really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah, he was installed as a member of the faculty, I want to say a year and a half ago.
Huh.
How interesting.
Actually, it was spring of 2008. Hmm. So 2 years. He's been on for 2.5 years.
I'll be darned. Cool. Yeah, he has a Gulfstream. That's good.
Yeah.
He knows how to live.
Sure does.
Yeah.
Well, our guest this episode is Rafael Marquez. He runs the iloveplanes.com blog. Which features aviation news. You can find photos there, videos, and a podcast that's on a little bit of a hiatus. Hi, Rafael. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, everybody. Thank you for having me here. I'm really looking forward to today, to being a guest on the show today.
Great. Well, we're glad to have you. Now, you've kind of been interested in aviation for a while, I think, right?
Yes, pretty much since I was maybe 4 or 5 years old. As soon as I figured out that there were these things with wings that flew, I've pretty much been interested in them since then.
Fantastic. That's what we like. Lifelong enthusiasts. All right. Coming up, we have a lot of exciting stuff. We're going to talk about some of the aviation news from the past week. Dan's going to join us a little bit later, as I mentioned, and he's got an exciting interview that I think we're going to have a great discussion around. And, of course, we have David's This Week in Aviation History segment. Also, the Australia Desk Report from Steve and Grant. But first, let's get started with the aviation news. And we have this from AOL News. This is called Planes Don't Kill People, Plane Exhaust Does. According to this article, there's been a study, and the fumes from airplanes are actually to blame for more annual deaths than actually occur in airplane crashes. And this comes from some work done at MIT. They use a computer model. They tracked plane emissions through the atmosphere, and they also kind of noted where those emissions were likely to fall. And then, according to this article, linked them to human deaths. Now, this study concluded that around 10,000 deaths per year can be blamed on airplane pollution. Just by way of comparison, only around 1,000 deaths are caused by crashes. So 10 times. Do you think this is a real story?
No. I saw the perfect gift for the folks that ran this report. Yeah. This morning, I think, or was it yesterday? I was in Corpus Christi yesterday. I went to visit the USS Lexington over there. And while I was walking around, there was this guy that had a shirt. And on the back of his shirt, it said, "I love the smell of jet fumes in the morning." I think we need to send every one of these researchers one of those shirts just to kind of say, "Hey, good job, guys. Yeah. Good job keeping the fear alive."
It kind of tends to do that. I know. You know, I mean, not to minimize it, because certainly emissions from airplanes is an issue. The contribution to greenhouse gases is obviously also an issue. So we don't want to minimize it.
I hate articles that have round numbers.
Yeah. Huh?
There's nothing worse to prove a study is faulty than the fact that it gives you a nice round number, like 10,000 deaths or 1,000 annual deaths. It's sort of a waste of time. And come on, guys. I mean, somebody actually sat around, and I'm sure it was government funded, to formulate this study. But, I mean, don't we have other things that we need to worry about?
I'm also dubious of it seems, I mean, and granted, we saw a write-up of the study rather than the actual study itself. But it would seem to me that what we're seeing is a correlative relationship rather than a causative one. That it talked about lung cancer and other respiratory diseases like that. That they're saying, well, the fumes and the pollution from the aircraft fell down over these areas, and look, there were this many deaths in these areas from respiratory issues. It completely discounted, you know, diesel fumes or other
sources.
Yeah, it's kind of an answer looking for a question.
Well, another thing also in that same article, they talk about how emissions from ships kill 60,000 people a year. So what are we supposed to do with that sort of information? It doesn't really give you anything to do. It just sort of says, hey, look, this is what we believe to be the facts, and that's it. It doesn't give you any kind of a solution, any kind of an action. It doesn't say anything.
Aviation seems to be a pretty convenient boogeyman for a lot of things. One of the things that I've always really wondered about is that when the purchasing carbon credits by passengers became the sort of in thing to do, there was a period of time where when airlines would announce their new routes, they would say, or equipment change of some sort. So they said, we are going to be saving X number of gallons of fuel a year, which correlates into X number of pounds of carbon dioxide. And if you did the calculations based on those numbers of gallons, you know, that number of gallons of Jet A times the weight of the Jet A per gallon, they were saying that they were saving more carbon dioxide emissions than actually the mass of the Jet A that was burned. Hmm. Which just seems a little odd to me, because you know, you're saying that there's more mass after the combustion and after it than before.
That's a neat trick, huh?
Yeah, I really love to know how they get those numbers.
Yeah. All right, Gavin. My takeaway from this article, though, is that I think we need to be concerned about emissions, pollutants caused by aircraft, but I'm not seeing anything here with this report that causes me to sort of, you know, accelerate my, you know, desire to do something or like you say, take some specific action. So
in other words, it's a really good headline.
It makes for a good headline.
Yeah, exactly. You know, if they're really worried about that, they're going to start, if it's a really an in-depth article about the problems and dangers of jet exhaust, you're going to start talking about bleed air systems and cabin, air pollution.
Right.
You're not going to start talking about the fallout from the engines, because, you know, in terms of a parts per million, any pollution factor is going to be much higher inside the cabin than out.
Did you guys already talk about automobiles? And I'm sure I figured somebody already mentioned that, right?
Automobiles were not mentioned, Bob. So
I guess I was thinking in the sense that pollution from automobiles has got to be so unbelievably much more of a threat than
sort of overwhelms this.
Yeah.
Good point.
And the country that they highlight as being most affected by this is India. And I mean, I've never been to India. I've only seen videos and things of India on TV. And anytime you see a picture of the Taj Mahal or anything going on any place in India, there's always this kind of brown layer of soot over the city and over the populated areas. Hmm. And I'm sorry, but you can't convince me that that comes from jet engines or from anything like that. Right. That's ground level pollution from cars, industry, and Lord only knows what else is on there.
Yeah, exactly.
Aviation is just really now in the last 10 years having starting to really grow in India. So I'd agree with you, Raphael. Yeah.
Okay, we see from the Toronto Sun that UAE, the United Arab Emirates, and Canada have a little trade war going on. And this has been escalating. Apparently, this is over airport slots. So too bad Dan's not here. The UAE is evicting, according to this article, some forces from a Canadian government base because of Canada's is I guess refusing to allow additional flights for Emirates and Etihad landing in Canada, and so it seems that the UAE is kind of retaliating a little bit because of that. The Canadians are maybe a little threatened by the UAE airlines, and that they may, you know, take up landing slots in Canada for international flights without really offering any flights, any capacity within Canada itself. This is a different view of slots and how people view the importance of slots.
It's definitely an odd thing that you don't give me slots, so I'm going to cancel your base. It's a very interesting airlines and military story that doesn't seem to happen too often. It's like,
you're right, David.
The only way the UAE could come up with some sort of negative penalty was to close a base that basically was set up by Canada to protect the UAE during the original Gulf War. So it's like, okay, why are you cutting off your foot? But that's only my opinion.
Well, but now, of course, they feel very important because, of course, they've ordered how many A380s? What do they have on 90 order?
Yeah, quite a lot.
Yeah. It's a lot of 380s. You know, when you're driving Hummers all over the place, essentially, you know, you think you're pretty cool.
I read that they wanted to bump their order up to 120, but they just didn't have the capacity at their home airport to handle 120 A380s.
Realistically, yeah, where the hell do you put 120 A380s?
Yeah.
I know Dover has 25 to 30 C5s, and it's a very large track of land in Delaware. I mean, 120 A380s, what are they thinking?
And well, they wouldn't be there all at the same time, hopefully.
Right.
I mean, that's kind of the trick, to keep them going away as much as possible.
Or at least towards Canada, right?
But, and you
or
still
at least
gotta,
towards Canada, right?
but Rob, in all fairness, you figure you got to park at least a quarter of the fleet. You can't have all 100 or 120 going at one time. 60 of them parking them someplace. You're going to have to park them someplace to begin with. I mean, that's just bizarre. It's just really, really bizarre.
And honestly, are you really going to have people flying from Los Angeles or Vancouver or San Francisco through Dubai to Sydney? I mean, are you really going to convince people to fly the wrong way around the world to fly through Dubai? I mean, because they're hitting a point where there just aren't that many destinations you serve from Dubai from these cities, you know, like Toronto or New York or San Francisco, where they, you know, they're now doing a 300 ER daily, or LA, you're really offering a value proposition to passengers by flying through Dubai.
Yeah, my question when I was reading about that was, where are they going to find all of these passengers that are willing to pay the extra money to fly on their planes through Dubai to wherever it is that they want to go? And I guess I don't know what that has to do with Canadian landing slots, but that was just one of the questions that I had in my head.
Yeah, that's kind of a frequent question, Raphael, with respect to these Middle Eastern airlines that are just amassing huge amounts of capacity. You know, it does make you wonder where all the passengers are going to come from.
And don't you another, remember that movie? If you build it,
they will come. Well, according to the
Well, regardless, they're still going to need some landing slots somewhere, and it doesn't look like anybody wants to give them any additional landing slots.
Think about it: a landing slot for an A380 is not your normal average run of the mill landing slot. You need a double decker ramp system, and you have to build infrastructure for an A380. It's not like you're parking a 737. There's an A380's got its own specific little problems.
Mm-hmm. That and your separation, 744. It's a 4-mile separation, and on an A380 you have to bump it up to 6.
Right, which has a big effect on the in scheduling and the rate at which you can bring airplanes into the airport.
They always talk about the Heathrow being a sort of A380 hub, but it either has to be, when you're talking about slot-constricted airports, yes, if you've got that many A380s coming in, then it's a more seats coming in and out of the airport. But if it's mixed, then all of a sudden you have to reduce the overall number of takeoffs and landings to account for the extra separation, both on takeoff and landing.
Yeah. Next comes from the Globe and Mail. Report urging use of drones raises questions about fighter jet deal. The Canadians are set to purchase a number of F-35 jets. I think it's, what, David, 65?
That's correct.
And, of course, that costs quite a lot of money. Some in Canada are wondering whether or not this is really affordable. And there have been some studies and some talk about some alternatives to the F-35s, or at least to as many of them. One idea is to keep going with the CF-18 planes. But there's also this interesting concept about using drones, maybe in a flocking kind of way. David, I think that's kind of interesting.
This is happening in Canada, and it's going to happen in the smaller countries like Canada or Australia or New Zealand. Well, why do we need it? Why do we need a manned jet fighter that costs X amount of dollars when we can build a cheap drone that can do the same thing? I think most people don't understand that drones have their limitations, but this is the first real argument that says we don't need manned fighters. We've got drones. Basically, the government of Canada wants to supplement their F-35 purchases with drones, but they don't. But everyone's going, well, if the drones are so good, why do we need the F-35? Mm-hmm. I think this is going to be an ongoing argument going forward in time, because a drone is unmanned. You don't lose a life, but you're still going to need manned air power. So the drones flocking, meaning that you could have several of them up at a time for one of Canada's biggest reasons for the F-18 is to patrol its very large open spaces for combat search and rescue. Well, we can do that cheaper with drones. It still doesn't mean that you don't have a force projection, which the F-35 will give them. Their F-18s are long in the tooth. So it's one of those, well, it may look cheaper on paper, but it's really not going to save you any money.
Interesting. I mean, this seems to be a recurring theme.
You're going to have drone strikes instead of Canada geese strikes. flocking means that you have a bunch of drones together that are working with each other to cover a large amount of space, where you could have 5 drones for the cost of one F-35. The F-35 probably still will do a better job, because you always want a pair of human eyes looking, whereas the drones, you might or might not work. So, but it's an argument dollar for dollar without looking beyond the other ramifications.
But are this CSAR, they're doing longer? I mean, what sort of payloads are their F-18s carrying doing these missions?
A bunch of fuel tanks. I mean, combat search and rescue is just that. It's search and rescue. Canada's got, and Australia is the same way, it's got huge tracts of land with nobody in it. you lose an airplane or someone's lost, you send out the aircraft that can try to find these people. I mean,
yeah,
it's doing it in a cost-effective method. Do you do it with an F-35 or do you do it with 10 drones? I mean, yes, they're very good at what they do, but no, they're not going to replace the F-35 as a manned strike fighter, which is what everyone's saying. If these drones are so good, why do we need the F-35s for? And people just don't understand that they're really using them for two different things.
Yeah, I mean, for the search and rescue, I mean, there's a much stronger argument that the drones can do the job. That being said, do they really need to spend $150 million a pop? I think it's getting into that range on F-35s for combat search and rescue, when they could easily buy CF-18Es or Fs to do the same thing at significantly less cost.
Well, let Gavin, first of all, there's no such thing as a CF-18E or F. They're stuck with legacy Hornets. They actually have early block A's and B's. So they're they're long in the tooth, and they're not and they have absolutely no interest in getting in do the Australian thing, which is get the late block F-18Es and Fs. Australia wants F-35s, and they need that for UN is Canada is really strong on UN protection and policing actions. They need the F-35s as a forward projection thing. They're not going to be able to forward project F-35s. Yes, in this particular role, the drones could do a comparable, if not better, job. But that does not mean that they will be able to do it later.
No, I would tend to agree. I mean, for the peacekeeping and for police action and multinationals, there's a very strong argument for having a more capable aircraft, and also for tech commonality. If the F-35 is going to be the sort of widespread fighter doing these things, you know, you have multiple nations all flying them from a forward maintenance standpoint, from a communication standpoint, it makes a lot of sense to have the F-35.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like, you know, the right aircraft for the right job. And something as advanced and as expensive as the F-35, I would think that you'd want to, you know, focus that on a very specialized kind of mission. And if there's other missions that don't require that kind of horsepower, so to speak, if drones or something else can provide that, that functionality, then at a lower cost, then, I don't know, makes sense to me.
Yeah, but that's not what they're arguing. The argument is, Max, that, well, if the drones can do X, Y, and Z really good, why do we need to spend money on the F-35? The F-35 might do A, B, and C better, but they're not arguing that. They're just saying the drones can do PDQ better, so therefore that's what we should buy, and forget the F-35. You need to balance. I don't think you'll ever have a completely drone Air Force. God help us if we do.
Yeah. All right, let's take a look at the Dallas News. They report that deal with pilots would let Southwest fly bigger 737s, making long routes viable. So Southwest and the pilots union have reached an agreement, a deal that would let Southwest operate a larger version of the 737, that, of course, being the Dash 800. The article notes that Southwest executives have indicated that they would like to bring a 175-seat version of that aircraft into their fleet. So the article reports that this tentative agreement, which now goes to SWAPA members, that's the union, goes to them for a vote in November, I guess, and that it would pay Southwest pilots, says, the same rate for the Boeing 737-800 as for the Boeing 737-500s. Which are smaller, and the Dash 300s and the Dash 700s as well. So, I mean, this is kind of interesting. Rob, you might have something to say about this too, in terms of, you know, having to negotiate with the pilots union basically concerning decisions about the fleet that you want to acquire.
Well, of course, this is kind of a follow-on to the agreement they got from the flight attendants last month, or actually it was a month and a half ago. But, you know, again, we're not talking about a huge difference in size. The only thing that really caused the negotiations to get a little crazy was that the size of the new airplane requires a fourth flight attendant. And so they've been hoping to avoid that for years. And now it's time to face the music. But as far as the pilots go, I mean, there's not going to be much a difference in pay for the pilots on an 800 versus a slightly smaller airplane. I mean, it's just not.
I'm just curious that the pay scale, it's the 735 and the 738 are comparable, and the 737-700 is different. You would think that there would be commonality between the two types of 737 NGs.
Yeah, you would.
Yeah, yeah.
You absolutely would. But of course, I haven't seen the pay scale for the pilots at Southwest in a while. I mean, and again, the range though between the top end airplane and the smaller airplane probably isn't as vast as most people might think it is.
Yeah,
Rob, I guess this is a question for us idiot military historians. Is there a difference if you fly a 737-800? To a 737-500, is your pay scale different?
Actually, it is. And the size of the airplane that someone flies has always been the determining factor on their pay. And it makes more sense when you're at a place like say United, where they had they have Airbus A320s, and they're also flying 747-400s and 777s, and there's a really wide variation in the size, the capacity of the airline, the aircraft. But you know, when you're at Southwest and you're talking about an airplane that carries 148 passengers versus 171 or 139, it's just they're different, but they're not vastly different. But they are still different in pay. You know what I'll do is I'll see if I can pull it up here while we're online, so hopefully I won't drop offline again, though.
And, Robert, I have a question for you about that. Does it require an entirely different set of skills to fly the Dash 800 versus the Dash 500 or the 700?
You got to be way smarter to fly a big airplane. I mean, I'm just kidding. No, of course it's the same. It's the same airplane. You know what? They get in that airplane, and the weight and balance is all done for them anyhow. The engines are virtually the same, and when a pilot gets in an airplane, all they really care about is the aircraft balanced? How much fuel does it have on board? How far are we going? And how much fuel does this thing burn an hour? And that is all they care about. Whether there are 141 people in the back or 159, they don't know and they don't care.
Now, Rob, if there is a correlation between aircraft size and intelligence, would that be the reason you've only flown the A380 once?
Hi, Dan. Well, thanks for coming in.
Would that be Dan?
Yes, Dan Webb has joined us.
Oh, goody.
That's an enthusiastic welcome.
Welcome, Dan.
Hey, Rob. How's Atlanta?
Well, Hotlanta's not too bad. I mean, the NBA show's getting going here. So we had the Dalai Lama in here yesterday. So,
wow. That's awesome.
Gavin was telling us he's on the faculty at
Emory.
Emory.
Emory. There you go. The university I can't think of the name of, but
so Dan, is this a big issue? We'll incorporate you into this real quick.
Okay, thanks, Dan.
What is the specific question about?
This is on Southwest.
Southwest pilots arguing over the fact that they've got 737-800s or 500s.
Well, I mean, if you're talking about difference, I mean, obviously there's a difference between the 500 and 800 because the 500 is a 737 classic. In terms of pay scale, I think it kind of makes sense to have them all on one scale. I'm not sure what and I have to go on one of the websites. Like, Rob, do you know if someone like a Continental or Alaska has different pay scales for each version of the 737?
My guess, let's see, how many versions does does Alaska have?
Both Continental and Alaska have
five,
the Alaska and Continental.
And
Alaska and Continental both have the 700, 800, and 900.
I would be very surprised if there wasn't a difference in the pay rates. Again, as we were speaking about before you came on, it's probably not vast. I mean, it's not certainly the difference between what a pilot on a 747-400 and an A380 is or an A320 is going to be paid. It's not like that, but there probably is a difference.
Mm-hmm. Actually, it looks like, and this is just through my Googling, it looks like Alaska has one. And let me look.
Has
and like,
one what, Dan?
Like one pay scale. I mean, I'm not sure how accurate some of these some
it's
of these
Wikipedia. It's Wikipedia. You're supposed to trust that like you were trusting your best friend. Not.
So you don't trust Wikipedia with your wife either, right?
Well, no. Well, that's because like... Well,
okay. That was so wrong.
Well, it just seems that so
Rob, I'm sure you love it when your students cite Wikipedia as a reference too, right?
Oh God!
This is an awesome website with pilot pay rates. I'm not sure how accurate the data is, but this is very accurate. WillFlyForFood.com.
What does it say about the Southwest? It doesn't say they all fly for the same money, does it?
No, I believe Southwest. I believe the swap up press release does say there will be a single pay rate for the 737.
Really? Wow.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
Let me load this. And
that
I don't
means
know,
everybody's got to be going up.
Yeah, I know. I don't know
except the guys flying the Boeing 717s from AirTran.
Well, that's not even that's a whole other issue. It says yes. Okay, the company has let me look at this. Oh, wait, this is quoting the SWAPA press release from last week. The agreement includes a single pay rate for the 737, profitability-based raise added to the hard 2% raise in 2011, a contract extension with an amendable date extended to September 2012, and a profitability-based raise in 2012. So if you're flying Southwest, if you're flying the 300, the 500, the 700, or 800, you are same rate.
Well, shut my mouth.
And then, Southwest... is a little different than other airlines in pay because I believe it's it's not hourly pay like other airlines. It's based
on
trip.
It's segments.
It's
yeah,
based
that,
on trip,
right.
Which is I forget what the distance of a trip is, but then it's 200 something miles, I think. I don't remember, but then it's so that divided so the length of the flight divided by that and whatever number of trips it comes out to be. So yeah. So I'm not sure what the other airlines do. I'm sure we have some pilots listening who might be able to help out on that.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, if we have some better information from our listeners, or if we uncover some ourselves, we should dial that into this conversation in the future. Certainly.
We're so confused.
Yeah. Help us.
I'm not confused. It's that there's just so many websites out there with pilot pay rates. I'm not always sure, you know, which website sure. is the best and stuff like that. But I'm sure the pilots out there who are listening, it is something that they track pretty carefully. So.
Yeah, give us some feedback. All right, well, in other union negotiation news, we have I guess this is a press release from the National Air Traffic Controllers Association. And this notes that NATCA and the FAA have resolved a safety issue at the Oakland Air Route Traffic Control Center. Wow, how exciting, right? This issue has to do with, sorry, Rob. The issue has to do with the vertical expansion of a MOA, a military operation area used by the Navy. Now, I guess, Rob, you can help us with this. The exciting part of all this is that instead of using a contractor, which is typically the case, I guess, with the FAA, in this case, they've asked their own the air traffic control and workforce to address this. Is that what the crux of this is, Rob?
I think that's really what makes this unique because in the last 2 years, of course, with the new administrator appointed by President Obama, who of course is Randy Babbitt, who's former president of the Airline Pilots Association, right. It completely changed the dynamics of the interactions between the controllers union and FAA because prior to that, when the old administrator was there, I mean, they all hated each other. I mean, they wouldn't even talk to each other. And so labor relations took a lower dip than before. And right now, I can't remember the name of the website, but if you go up there, you can find out what is the most popular government agency to work for and which is the least popular.
Yeah.
And out of 250, FAA has always been 248, 249, somewhere in there.
Wow.
And they've gone up a few points, not much, but this is a step in the right direction at least.
Okay. All right. One thing I wanted to note, so this is sort of newsy. It's more actually about an event. This is San Francisco's Fleet Week Air Show. Now, Gavin, I understand that you attended that event.
I did. I did. I actually saw both days of it because I live in San Francisco, and so all you had to do is look up.
Now you've got kind of an amazing collection of photographs you put up on Facebook.
Oh, thank you.
Did so? You actually took those, huh?
I did.
Yeah, impressive. So tell us about what you saw at Fleet Week. What were the main attractions? What were the highlights for you?
Well, I mean, obviously the Blue Angels are always going to be the headline grabbers. Whenever they perform, the only time they might, well, granted, they never perform at the same time as the Thunderbirds, but that's about the only other aerobatic team that could even hold a candle to them. Hmm. We also had an F-18F Super Hornet doing some maneuvers, a pass-by by a couple of F-16 Vipers who really didn't do much other than, fly past and turn around and come back. We had a couple prop aerobatic displays, one by the Oracle team and one by the Geico team. We also had two search and rescue demonstrations, one by the Coast Guard, one by the Navy. We had the Patriots who fly, who are a civilian, all ex military pilots, but they're all civilians flying, I believe it's L-39s, a Czech plane.
Oh, yeah.
And
albatrosses.
Not exactly the name you would think of when you were thinking of an aerobatic squadron. And then we had the United had a 747 that did a couple passes and came by and flew by very slowly. And that was about it. It was about a 3-hour show from start to finish.
Wow. Now, is this an annual event?
Fleet Week is an annual event in San Francisco.
And they do this over the bay, I would imagine?
They do. For those who are familiar with the Bay Area, the show flight line was pretty much online between Alcatraz and the Golden Gate Bridge.
Oh, wow.
So they were flying through by the marina. And which was the main show area.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
We'll put a link to your Facebook page with all those photos on the notes for folks to take a look at. There are really some nice photos. What kind of equipment did you use? What any tips for air show photography?
No, I actually have a background going back about 6-7 years in spot news, sports, and nature photography. So I have quite a kit that I've assembled over the years. Most of these shots were on a Nikon D300 digital SLR on a Nikon 200 or 400 f/4 zoom lens. Steve Frischman will know what I'm talking about. But that's very much a sports photography setup, and
sure,
when you're dealing with things that are moving as quickly as that, the speed. The shutter actuation speed and the autofocus speed really make a big difference. And also having long glass that can really bring you in and get in close and blur out the backgrounds with a decently low f-stop really go a long way to helping produce nice images.
Yeah, I was going to make a comment about your shutter speed because the propellers are stopped dead in their tracks, and sometimes if you use a slightly slower shutter speed, you can see some movement in the propellers. But your shots, the propellers are all stopped in motion right there. So I like your shots, by the way. They're really, really good.
I appreciate it. Yeah, it's coming from a sports and nature background, you're generally, unless you're really trying to do a motion blur, which is done in certain situations, and, you know, it's really something that the hardware is actually going for. A lot of times you're just trying to shoot at the, freeze the action and shoot at the highest shutter speed possible.
I had did a podcast with this guy named Bernardo Malfitano. He runs a site called airshowfan.com, which ironically doesn't have any of his airshow pictures on there. He's got them all on his Facebook profile. But he went down to Rio for the Red Bull Air Race down there, and he took some really great action shots, and he's got the motion blur on the propellers spinning. And, for that kind of a picture, I think it adds some drama to the shot, but your shots are really good too.
Thank you. I mean, admittedly, this is the first time I've ever really gone out focusing on shooting aircraft, and so
what the hell is wrong with you? You should have been doing that since you were like 5 years old.
Shame.
I know.
Shame.
I know. It really is a sad situation. I really haven't had the, granted I could have gone spotting, but I really haven't had the opportunity to, quite honestly.
But Gavin, in all fairness, with your backgrounds that you get to shoot in for Fleet Week, and it's a lot easier to shoot really good pictures because you've got things like the Golden Gate Bridge and Alcatraz behind you. That always helps.
Yeah, you know what? It makes life a lot easier. Also, we were really lucky in the weather. San Francisco is known for its fickle weather, and we had two beautiful, clear days. You know what happens with the Blues is that if they can't, they have a box, their show box, and if they can't visually see all four corners of the box, they won't fly their standard issue program. They'll fly a higher altitude program, and they'll push back. They'll come back from. They'll create more of a safety margin for themselves.
Okay, Gavin,
it's a very smart thing.
Okay, Gavin, here you go. Blue Angel lesson number one. Mm-hmm. The Blue Angels have three shows: a high show, a medium show, and a low show, otherwise known as the flat show. Depending upon the cloud cover at the moment of takeoff, they make a determination whether they are going to go to the high show, the medium show, which is called the rolling show, or the flat show. Those three shows, in this case, by your pictures, you've got the high show. And they can change, unlike the Thunderbirds, who make a decision at the moment of takeoff and don't do anything afterwards, the Blue Angels will vary their show. They can, if the clouds are coming in, they can go from a high show to a rolling show or to a flat show. The Thunderbirds, they take off. There's one little cloud in the sky. They will go to a flat show. That's been my experience. But that's the three different shows that they have set up for both teams.
Yeah, very cool.
We were very, very lucky with our weather.
Well, Gavin, maybe we'll use one of your photos, if that's okay, for the blog post for this episode.
Yeah, that'll be great. Thank you.
Cool. Gavin, thanks for standing in for the news segment. We really appreciate it. Raphael, tell us a little bit about your site, iloveplanes.com. What was sort of the origin of that? What led you to create that website?
Well, I've been an aviation fan, and I've always loved airplanes pretty much since I can remember. And it's always been something that I've sort of kept it as a really bad secret where, you know, if I was driving by the airport and there was a plane coming in for a landing, I'd always say, you know, wow, look at that. That just looks beautiful. Can you imagine all the physics involved in having that plane fly and staying up and then keeping everybody inside, you know, protected and safe and everything? And everybody that was ever in the car with me would just look at me like, dude, you're nuts. And so, you know, for years I've had this, and I've always wanted to be a pilot. And I took flying lessons. I got my private pilot's license. And so it was sort of my secret that I didn't tell anybody, but I told everybody, kind of a thing. And then eventually it just got to a point where I just decided that I wanted to talk about my love of planes and my passion for airplanes. And so I thought, well, what better name than I Love Planes? And so that's where that came from. And so, yeah, that's pretty much how it started.
How long ago did you start the site?
It's about a year old now.
Really? That's it? That's young. And you were able to get that I Love Planes site name. That's great.
Yeah, I found out after I bought it, and I found out that some lady in England had it before me. And apparently she let it expire in 08, and I bought it in 09. But yeah, because whenever I went over to compete and I was trying to sign up for an account so I could do some analytics tracking and what have you, and it had some lady's name in England as the registered owner for the domain, and that's how I figured that one out.
Interesting. Now, for people who are, you know, thinking about creating a site, I'm sort of interested in some of your thoughts in terms of creating content. You know, you have a lot of news items. Where do you find things? I mean, where do you get the content that you capture for your site?
I've got a lot of different sources. I have a Google alert that runs. I only have it email me once a day. I had it send it to me as it happens, but it was just too much to handle. And so I created a Google alert with some phrases and some words that I'm interested in.
I find those very helpful. Yeah.
Yeah. So I get that once a day. And then I also created some Twitter searches that I run every so often. And I used to practically live on Twitter, but then I discovered this little site called paper.ly.
Mm.
And what that does is it lets you create a virtual newspaper based on the profiles of certain people that you tell it to check for. And so anything that's related to the subject that you're interested in that these folks tweet about shows up in your newspaper. And that's one way so that runs once a day also. And I just go back to my Paper.ly site and I look and see what's in there. And sometimes there's just too much, and I have a hard time picking one or two things, and other times there isn't a lot in there. So, but yeah, those are my two main tools.
And about how much time do you spend on the website?
It really varies. If it's something that I'm creating from scratch, like if it's a photo montage or something along those lines, a report that I'm writing, like I'm going to work on one from my visit to the Lexington. I have another one that I'm still working on from a conversation that I had with some folks in the Civil Air Patrol, and that was interesting in and of itself.
Mm, I bet.
Those will usually take me a little bit longer to put together. Those are probably maybe 5 to 6 hours worth of work, if not longer than that.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, I have a rule that I don't want to spend more than an hour total time on a post. So if it involves rewriting, or if it involves, whatever kind of work I have to do in order to get a post up on the site, I try to keep it under an hour because I have other things to do.
Sure. You have the rest of your life, right?
Yes. But I still want to get my thing out there, you know? And it's really easy to spend 3-4 hours, you know, worrying about whether you should use is it a or an?
Yeah.
Which one is that? And it's just too much work if you think about it at that level. And really, you know, it's a personal site. If I were writing for some big publication, you know, maybe I would, like Aviation Week or something like that, maybe I'd be more worried about using proper grammar and what have you.
Sure.
But, you know, I just write whatever it is that I'm thinking about. And sometimes it's kind of borderline inappropriate, and other times it's not. So there you have it.
Sure. Dan, how much time do you spend on your blog?
The amount of time I spend on my blog, it really varies. Like, I think there was one day last week where I didn't even post just because I was in the middle of midterm, so it kind of fell by the wayside. So, like, physically writing, maybe 40 minutes a day, 40, 50 minutes a day. And it kind of depends on like how much research I'm doing. And I mean, if it's a big, you know, if like a huge story comes out, I mean, that might take a little bit more. But other than that, I mean, if I have some free time, I'm spending a few hours because I'm like always checking Twitter and always just reading news, like just looking for stuff. Because I mean, might not always be something that I'm interested in writing about or that's worthy of a post. Because generally, if I can't really add anything, I don't think my blog is just like a pure news site. Like, I look for stuff that I can, you know, maybe add an opinion. But there's, I'm always looking at news that way. You know, if I am writing about in a certain airline, I just, you know, I'm up with all the news. So it kind of varies, but, you know, probably no more than an hour per post.
Rob, how do you identify topics for Jetwine?
Of course, I have help, which makes a big difference. Because Scott Spangler and I both write for Jetwine. And, sure. You know, Scott tends to post every week. I don't post quite as much as I did, but then I tend to kind of wait until I've got something, like I'm working on something for tomorrow that I'm really fired up about. And, you know, that tends to take more time to kind of make it all come together, almost like a short article in it, but it has to kind of all make sense to me. So, but you know, again, and I think, like everybody else, I kind of depend upon the news, whether it's coming through traditional media, or whether I see a Google alert online. And I mean, that's just such a great way to find out, what's happening. And of course, I'll very often simply react to another blog post sometimes, you know, either saying, wow, that was an incredible point, I loved it, or you are completely out to lunch. And you have to spend time with this, and I think we've all seen that, and I still hear that. You know, we're having a big social media gig down here at the NBAA show, and that's one thing people have already been asking, is that how much time is this going to take? And it's kind of like asking how much a really expensive car costs. If you have to ask, you probably really don't want to be involved in it.
Right.
But, you know, and again, you could spend a lot of time on this, as I'm sure everybody knows. And but then sometimes the results are really spectacular, too.
Yeah. And I think that's part of the message here, is that for most people, you know, beginning to go down a path of blogging or creating an aviation website or even a podcast is often a serious time commitment. Raphael, you had a few podcast episodes in the past. Is that right?
Yes. My aviation podcast has what's the word I'm looking for? It is on a hiatus for the time being, and it's because I'm working on retooling it. I felt like I really didn't have a point in the podcast. Mm-hmm. And if I didn't have a point, then what was the point, sorry for using that word so many times, of doing the podcast?
Sure.
And so what I'm wanting to do with the podcast more moving forward, and what I'm working on, is trying to focus it more on talking about a specific plane. So, because that falls more in line with the title of the site and everything else. So talk about, you know, be it the P-39, the P-63, or the B-25 Mitchell bomber, whatever. But just talk about in the podcast about a specific plane, and just take it off that way. And because I think that'll help me both find a more focused audience, but also help the podcast stay focused and stay on target and not meander so much on different things.
You know, that is such an interesting point that you mentioned, Raphael, because I think although people that are into social media love doing what they're doing, quite a few of them have never thought about, why am I doing this again? Because I love it. But they don't really have a point other than that.
I do it for chicks, actually.
Yeah.
hasn't worked out yet.
Yeah, I was going to say, how's it working out? And you know, I think when you do a podcast that is just simply one person kind of rambling about, and I'm sorry, I don't mean you specifically. I haven't heard your podcast. We've all heard podcasts like that, and you might listen once, maybe twice, and you go, if I don't get anything from it, or if it's not even interesting or unique, why should I waste my time on that?
And this is why none of us listen to Plane Crazy Down Under.
Oh, no.
Burn.
I love listening to that.
You're a terrible person, Dan.
I'm sorry.
I'm recusing myself as usual from the slanders that are about to emanate from various co-hosts.
Did I
really just hear that?
Yeah, I can't even believe it. Look.
I love Stephen Grant. No, seriously, they have a really good show. The only reason I did that is because, you know, sometimes I single out Rob, and
you want to spread the love around, huh?
Yeah.
So you're spreading the ridicule, Dan?
Basically.
This is podcast bullying.
Right.
Podcast. Hey, now see, that could be a podcast. Podcast Bullies.
The Pahater Show.
Yeah.
Yeah. A reality show. Podcast.
It'd be like what was that movie? Mad Max. You know, two podcasts enter, one podcast wins, or whatever they say.
Yes.
Two men enter, one man leaves.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. Yeah.
Got to get out more, Dan.
Maybe we could do just a little bit of word association. Raphael, we do this little game sometimes with our first-time host. First-time guests. Yeah, we should do it with the host. First-time guests, where we just pop out a word or a phrase and ask you just to start talking about the first thing that pops into your head.
Okay.
Who's going to go first? Who's going to go first, Mr. Max? Who's going to go first?
I'll go first.
Okay. Very good. Okay, David.
I'm always the teacher's pet, so I might as well.
Go ahead, David.
Okay, hang on. Let me first engage my PG-13 filter.
Yes.
Okay, filter engaged.
All right.
Okay.
Go, David.
Okay, Raphael, I heard a letter and a couple of numbers that aren't normally talked about come out of your mouth recently. P-63.
Yeah.
Yes. They're just down the road from me. I live in Kyle, Texas, and just down the road from me is a wing of the Commemorative Air Force, and they're housed at the airport here in San Marcos. And in there, they have a P-63F, and they only built two of those bad boys, and one of them is here in San Marcos. And I just happened to be there when the kind of a long story, but let me make it short. The first time I went to visit the Commemorative Air Force hangar, they had just received this plane in different crates from the Houston wing. And so the plane had been disassembled. Apparently the plane hadn't been particularly well maintained or something along those lines. And so they got it and it was all in pieces and it was spread out across the floor of the hangar. One of my other visits that I went there, they were putting the engine into an 18-wheeler that was taking the engine to California someplace to get rebuilt. On a different occasion, the engine had just come back from California. And then this last time that I went, they were putting the plane back together. And so on my site, I have a bunch of pictures that I took from my last visit there to the Commemorative Air Force hangar there in San Marcos. And it's pictures of the P-63F.
Wow. Very cool.
They also have one of three, is what they've told me, one of three P-39s that are still airworthy happens to share the same hangar with the P-63. And true to its reputation of being kind of a hard plane to fly, the P-39 had some damage on one of its wings because it apparently had a runway overrun accident of some kind, and it hit one of the runway lights somewhere, and it damaged the leading edge of the wing, and so it was being repaired. But yeah, it's also there.
I love this warbird restoration stuff and the people that make sure that these airplanes keep flying. I think that's just it's like a calling, I suppose, but I think it's something that I really appreciate anyway.
Yeah, and I was talking to, because everybody's a colonel in the CAF, right? And I was talking to Colonel Steven there, and he was telling me that somebody's grandkid is really, really into the whole fixing airplanes and what have you. And they like having him around because the kid is small enough and his hands are small enough that they can fit, you know, they can have him stick his hand through some hole somewhere and unscrew something or screw something in that they can't reach.
Yeah, that'd be very handy, I would think. Okay, yeah, that's so good.
You know, they're encouraging him for that. And that's all I have to say about that.
Okay, Rob, do you have a word for Raphael?
Oh, yes, I do, actually. Dan Webb.
That's two words again, Rob.
All right, Dan.
Wow, I just... I feel we've encountered some kind of slippery slope that leads to disaster.
No. I think only a person that's abjectly paranoid would think something like that. Raphael probably has nothing but incredible things to say, I bet. But let's give him a chance.
Okay, what you just said is proof that you were married to a psychologist.
Ah,
abjectly paranoid?
God, it is rubbing off, isn't it? Sorry.
It seems to be. I don't know, Raphael, you got anything to say about that?
About Dan Webb?
Yeah. Or about the objectively paranoid?
The objectively paranoid. Well, I've been accused of being paranoid, but with a different word in front of it. One that's not quite PG-13. But you know, Dan, I like his site. I like his board, his Things in the Sky blog.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
I think, you know, I mean, I think you're using the rubric theme on here with WordPress. I would change
K2 actually.
K2? Yeah. You know, it's a good site. I like it.
Thank you.
All right, Dan, it's now it's time for your
Jet
to reciprocate.
One.
You guys are good. You guys are making it tough for Raphael.
Wow, 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 wow.
I guess I deserve that.
You do.
Well, Jetwine is a different story.
See, and I heard the way his voice kind of went down. That's okay.
No, I'm just kidding. I'm just messing with you. Jetwine, I like your site also. Yours and Dan's were actually one of the first sites that I started reading more frequently back when I started I Love Planes. And so I like both of y'all's sites a lot. I think y'all's focus is slightly different, but you guys both have really good and useful information.
Well, and I, of course, tried to spell the words correctly, but it's a large focus.
Wow.
It's all this work, but.
Yeah, I'm not.
Oh, like, I know. Here we had it going nice, and then I jumped in and messed it up.
Flushed it.
No, I'll be honest. Sometimes I rush a little bit, like, because usually, like, I don't know about you, like, usually since I'm, like, writing about something recent, like, I usually don't have blog posts in the pipe. Like, I sit down one morning and go, like, what am I going to write about today? So sometimes I rush. And actually, what's great, I have some people on Twitter who are, like, you know, actually read my blog and then, like, message me and a lot of times be like, hey, dude, you I think a couple weeks ago I had fuel thanks instead of fuel tanks. And fortunately, the Twitterati were out there to help me.
Yeah,
I love that. Yeah, I love
that.
That's
what we do, right? We look after you, Boy Wonder.
Yep. All right, Gavin, are you still out there? Do you have a word for Raphael?
Maybe a name. Can you guys hear me?
But you have to tell us what it is.
Okay, what name?
Kelly Johnson.
Kelly Johnson. He worked for Skunkworks, didn't he?
He was Skunkworks. Well, I mean, yes. He ran the Skunkworks.
Yes. So Kelly Johnson, well, there's what I think of. I think of Skunkworks immediately. And I think of the Blackbird SR-71. I think of the U2. I think of Gary Powers. I think of even the X-15. I think of Chuck Yeager. That's the road I head down when I hear Kelly Johnson. And okay. Actually, you know what? I've read this cool thing about the Blackbird that they were all handmade. And since they were all handmade, they were all slightly different from each other. And each plane had its own kind of personality. And some of them were testy and some of them were really quite pleasant to work with, from what I understand. And so, yeah, that's Kelly Johnson.
Good for you.
Yeah, very good. Very good. So, Raphael, I was going to add, this is going to sound like I just thought of it after what just preceded. But actually, this is something that I came in with from the start. I was going to ask you about your favorite podcasts, other than this one, of course.
Other than this one, I like the TED sessions a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So I like to, I'm subscribed to those, and I tend to listen to those fairly regularly. As far as aviation podcasts, I really only listen to this one.
Good answer. Bravo.
Excellent.
Well, obviously you have really superb taste.
Well, you know, this is a fun podcast. You guys have made, in every episode that I've listened to, you guys always make it really interesting to listen to what's going on. It's not a lot of going off topic. You guys tend to stay on topic. It's a fun conversation. It's like you're sitting in the living room with these guys talking about aviation. And, you know, the only thing that's missing is the virtual beers and what have you. You know, and I like that. I like that.
Yeah, well, thanks.
That kind of atmosphere. So
that's good to know. Yeah, that's good to know. And for those of you that don't like it, well, tough.
And Raphael, now by being a guest, you get to hear all the outtakes.
Oh, yeah. Woohoo. Yeah. Except I heard them in real time, though. So it may not, I don't know. We'll
right.
see.
Not have the same effect.
Are you from San Marcos originally?
No, actually, I'm one of those dirty, rotten foreigners. I'm from Venezuela.
Aha.
Oh, no kidding. Wow.
Yeah. And so I came here to, well, long story short, I've lived more out of Venezuela than I have in Venezuela. And so I've been here in the Austin, San Marcos general area for about 22 years now. But I've always lived in different countries. So
very good. All right. Well, we'd like to really thank you for coming on the show. Raphael's site again is www.iloveplanes.com. And Raphael, you're also on Twitter?
Yes, I'm on Twitter, and it's Raphael Marquez.
All right, great. Again, Raphael, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, guys. It's been a great, great time.
Recently, Dan Webb was able to conduct an interview with David Cush. He's the Virgin America CEO. Dan, you want to set this up?
Yeah, I got to talk with David last week, and really, for actually, I got always get
hold
props.
Hold it! You're on a first name basis now.
Well, David, the first time I interviewed him, I'm like, "Do you prefer David or Mr. Cush?" And he said, "You know, call me David." So,
all right,
okay.
But actually, I gotta give props to Virgin America because this is, I think, the third or fourth time I've been able to chat with him this year. So it's pretty cool. Virgin America was celebrating their launch of Orlando service this week, and he was given a few interviews, and I was able to catch up with him, which was really awesome. So the first clip I have, I figured it was appropriate. I just asked him about, obviously Orlando is only a few days old station, but I wanted to ask how the market was looking so far.
It's looking very strong, and as a matter of fact, I went through some numbers this morning that are showing the bookings of Orlando in the early days versus the same period for Fort Lauderdale when we started Fort Lauderdale in November. And San Francisco Orlando is booking up much stronger than Fort Lauderdale did much earlier. And LA is slightly stronger. So we're quite happy straight out of the gate with the results.
And then next, obviously, I think the biggest news that it had happened industry-wise since I had last caught up with him was Southwest AirTran. And I, you know, I wasn't sure, like, really what he would say, just because, Gavin, you might know this better than me. I really don't think AirTran and Virgin America have any direct overlap on any route.
The only ones I could imagine would be Orlando.
But I don't think AirTran has any transcons out of Orlando. So
no, they don't. Their transcons are LAX, San Diego, which is seasonal, and San Francisco.
Yeah. All right. Cool. So yeah. And then obviously they've been competing with Southwest on some of the intra California from the get go. But I just want to ask what you thought about industry wide. So let her rip, Max.
Well, I'll say a couple of things on that. Number one, we are supportive of consolidation in the industry. That we think it does result in a healthier, more stable industry, which is, you know, good for investors, good for employees of these companies, and ultimately good for passengers. And we think the AirTrans-Southwest merger is one that doesn't really raise any big competition issues because all of these airports are open airports. That being said, you know, where consolidation goes in and reduces competition, we do have a problem with it. And we had a big problem with the United Continental merger for that reason. Those guys are dominant at Newark and Chicago, which are two airports we've been trying to get into for 3 years. So the reason I bring that up is because the Southwest AirTran merger doesn't cause these kind of problems. So we can get into any of those airports and compete with Southwest. But that's not the case with other mergers.
So then just to go off that with the closed airport issue, my next question, which I had talked to David about before, was the Newark compromise. Well, that's not the official deal, but basically DOJ gave their seal of approval on the United Continental merger after they agreed to give away slot pairs at Newark to Southwest so they could launch service to Newark. So I asked him his thoughts about that.
Southwest will operate short-haul flights out of Newark. Those are will be the least damaging to Continental, and those are the ones that have the most competition already. We would have put in flights to LAX and to San Francisco where it would cause the most competitive harm to United now. The fact is they've got a monopoly market on Newark-San Francisco now that those two airlines have combined, and they operate all but one frequency on Newark to L.A., one operated by American. And that's it's just outrageous that the government allowed that to happen, number one. And number two, allowed Continental to go in and choose who they were going to compete against. That's not the way competition policy is supposed to work. And now it's you know, the passengers that want to fly between Newark and the West Coast who are going to pay and pay dearly.
So I thought those were some very interesting, pretty strong words, I felt, especially as calling it outrageous. So I just found that very interesting. Next question, which was very quick. Virgin's been talking about a full-year operating profit for this year for a while, so I wanted to see if that changed at all.
The wild card, of course, is oil prices, and we're keeping a close eye on what's going on there. You know, it's bubbling up into the 80s, and, you know, fuel prices, jet fuel's about 50% more expensive than it was at this time last year, so that's pretty significant. All of that being said, though, you know, I'm still sticking to my guns here that we're expecting a full-year operating profit this year.
And then the last two questions are just for Stephen Grant. So the first one, I mean, Virgin over the past, you know, few months has been adding some interline partners, but I was also wondering about, you know, will they start code-sharing with anybody? So this was his answer.
We probably will not be doing code share this year. We've still got some system changes we need to make. But I would say a filing for code share with Virgin, with V Australia, is fairly imminent. That filing will certainly happen this year.
And then on a related note, I also was wondering about Virgin America also now has frequent flyer partnerships with Virgin Blue via Australia and Virgin Atlantic. So I was wondering some thoughts on that. So this clip is just for Stephen Grant. This is about the Virgin Blue via Australia partnership.
The amount of traffic exchange between Virgin Blue via Australia and Virgin America is pretty strong. As a matter of fact, it's very strong.
So those are just the highlights. If I played the whole thing, it'd take about 15 minutes. So hopefully later this week, depending on where you listen to it, I will have the full interview text up on my blog. So feel free to check that out. But yeah, I mean, thanks as always to Virgin for the opportunity. They're really great with us.
Yeah, good job. Good job.
Thank you.
You know, he reminded me a little bit of Air Canada in that article that we were talking about, the landing slots for Emirates and those other folks. He seemed to have sort of the reverse complaint or the other side of the coin, where he wants landing slots in airports where he can't have any for whatever reason.
Yeah. I mean, obviously if you're the new guy in the block, obviously you want as much access as possible. And I mean, the whole slot system is, it's such a regulatory, I don't want to call it a mess, not that it's a bad thing, it's just a complex system. And I mean, if you're a new entrant carrier, if you're looking for slots at a place like LaGuardia or Newark or Washington Reagan, the opportunity does not always present itself. I mean, that's why you saw so many applications for Washington National a couple weeks ago. And I mean, the I mean, it's very rare that some, I mean, do off transactions occasionally. I mean, it's, you know, sometimes, you know, very rare opportunities. I mean, the reason Southwest has slots at LaGuardia is because they were able to purchase the slot, ATA's old slots, and ATA had gone bankrupt at that point. Or with American and JetBlue, JetBlue was able to get slots at that was just a, you know, a one-time transfer with American to get a few slots to do DC Washington Reagan service. So, which starts in a couple weeks, actually. So yeah, it's an interesting issue.
I think it's just really incredible how the landscape has changed in the last couple of weeks between United and Continental consolidating their merger, and then just how drastically everything shifted with this Southwest AirTran announcement. Because all of a sudden, Southwest was always sort of the little guy nipping at the heels of the giant legacies, and now they've got Reagan, they've got national access, they've got a lot more LaGuardia access. They just got all this extra Newark access from out, you know, out of Continental United, and all of a sudden they're really not that little anymore. And I don't think they have been for a while, but they've always managed to maintain this persona of being a little low cost carrier who's trying to take, you know, to go up against the big guys. But they're the big guys now.
It's really funny you mention that, because actually, I was talking to a freshman business professor of mine last week, and because he was doing the Southwest case for his class, and actually, I'll be going in this week to talk to the freshman about it. But I mean, the, I think the case was updated. Well, my version of the book from a couple of years was updated 06. I think theirs might be updated 07 or 08. But still, any case written, any business case about Southwest is now completely out of date, and even before the AirTran merger. I mean, when, you know, a lot of Southwest case studies would write, I don't know about this one that I was looking at, but would write, oh, Southwest, you know, avoided close airports close into cities, which, you know, I wouldn't say is totally true with airports like LAX and Love. But then when Southwest goes to LaGuardia and then Boston after being in Providence and Manchester for some years, that airline has changed dramatically in the past few years. And
they have the scale to compete. They started out going into those small secondary airports, but once they got up a critical mass, they were able to compete a lot better and were able to shift from going from the secondary airports to the major ones.
Well, and then plus, I mean, I think a lot of these smaller airports presented strong opportunities to bring in low fare service. And I think a lot of the cities they expanded to in the mid-90s, I mean, there are some great opportunities. But eventually, I mean, if you're just staying with the lower 48, I mean, eventually you start really narrowing down your possibilities of where you can expand. And I mean, really, I think at this point, excluding the AirTran merger, I mean, I think the really only two big metro areas that don't have Southwest service right now are Charlotte and Atlanta, and the AirTran merger would bring a service, would have Southwest service at both. I mean, most notably Atlanta with that large hub.
Yeah.
Dan,
I'm really curious what's going to start happening at Reagan National, which were able to command a premium because of the proximity. And all of a sudden you got Southwest going in and going to upset the order of things.
I really don't know exactly what – I don't know exactly the nature of the slots that AirTran has. Like the ones that are up for grabs right now, obviously you have the perimeter rule, but I'm pretty sure DOT said like these have to go to small or medium hub airports. So I'm not entirely certain how much flexibility Southwest has with those slots. But yeah, I agree. I mean, and plus it's just interesting – with Southwest having such a large hub in Baltimore, but I'd assume it'd be something, you know, it'd be a limited presence at Reagan for the business traveler, and you'd have Baltimore as a larger hub. Plus, I mean, Baltimore is probably going to – I mean, Baltimore obviously doesn't have the perimeter rule, so you can have some longer haul flights. And, I mean, Baltimore – Southwest says they don't – I mean, they've always maintained that, you know, we don't have hubs. We have focus cities. But, I mean, Baltimore has become a big driver of connecting traffic. So,
Raphael, yeah. Did you have something?
Well, I just had a question about what do you guys think about the Wright Amendment? The Wright Amendment was the rule that created DFW Airport and basically restricted any airlines or anybody operating out of Dallas Love Field to the surrounding states around Texas. Do you guys think that the repeal of that had anything to do with Southwest now being able to, you know, grow like it has to the point where it can just swallow up another airline?
A couple of things. First, I believe the Wright Amendment came after DFW was already in the works. It was more of a response to Southwest, if I remember my history correctly. The other thing is, Wright has been repealed a little bit in terms of Southwest has, you know, more ease selling tickets. But it's not until 2014 where they can really fly anywhere in the country without restriction. And that'll be interesting because at that point, depending on the result of the union votes as well as, you know, Southwest's final decision, conceivably Southwest will have 737-800s at that point. It'll be interesting if those are used at Dallas. I think they will in how they're utilized, because Southwest did say, you know, we can use these airplanes at restricted airports. I forget exactly if they meant slot. Actually, give me 1 second, Max. I'm sorry.
Almost.
Damn. Almost there. Calm down.
No, I was going to actually say ask a question about Wright Amendment.
I'm almost there. Yeah, so basically with Southwest saying that they can use the 737-800, you know, airports that are restricted at, you know, by slots or by gates. And that's interesting because I'm pretty sure I'd have to double check that the Wright Amendment compromise restricts the number of gates at Love Field. So I would fit. My theory is that the 800 and the repeal of the Wright Amendment go hand in hand.
Okay. Thanks, guys.
Well, Gavin, what was your question, though?
The sense that I always got about the Wright Amendment and its continued existence had a lot to do with American Airlines' interest at DFW.
That's how I always remembered it also. I mean, I'm not saying that I'm right or wrong. That's just the perception that I had of the deal, and probably Dan is more right than I am.
Yeah, I forget the exact history of how it all worked out, and I know that's a shame because I've read Lamar Muse's book Southwest Passage recently, and I forgot. Yeah.
Okay, for next
someone,
time.
Someone Wikipedia this.
But can I just make one comment that I think is very germane to this? I mean, Dan will always probably be more right than anyone here.
Are you sure about that?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. That's completely false. I mean, once we go from airlines to GA and BizAv, like, no.
Oh, I thought we were talking about politics.
Oh.
I got that joke from the beginning.
Okay. See?
No, I didn't get that. I'm sorry.
All right, sorry. Okay.
I'm too young.
Go ahead, Max.
And now? And now, with his This Week in Aviation, here's David Vanderhoof, the official Airplane Geeks historian.
Thanks, Max. Welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 2, Episode 33, October 17th through October 23rd. October 17th, 1922, a Voight VE-7SF, piloted by Lieutenant Virgil C. Griffin of VF-1 Squadron, makes the first takeoff from a United States aircraft carrier, the USS Langley. The Langley was converted from the Collier Jupiter. She was a flat-deck carrier with no superstructure. The Langley was anchored in the York River near Norfolk at the time. Griffin recovered on land and not on the aircraft carrier. October 18th, 2002, the Boeing Phantom Works reveals the existence of the Bird of Prey. The Bird of Prey was named after the Klingon one found in
Star Trek. It was a stealth technology demonstrator. The aircraft first flew in the fall of 1993 and made 40 flights through 1999. To keep expenses down, the aircraft used a JT-15D built by Pratt & Whitney, which is commonly found on Citation jets and Beach jets. Now, how's that for a military history tie-in to MBAA-10, Rob? It is speculated that the aircraft tested active camouflage, which is the ability to match the local environment, i.e. in science fiction, cloaking, another reason for the reference to Star Trek. It's this military avgeek's opinion that the have glass program for F-16s and the metallic sheen on F-22s and F-35s are a direct result of the Bird of Prey program. Hmm. The sole Bird of Prey can be found at the Museum of the United States Air Force in Dayton, Ohio. On October 19th, 1901, Albert Santos Dumont wins 100,000 franc prize for the ability to pilot a dirigible around the Eiffel Tower. Santos Dumont set out to prove that controlled flight was indeed possible. The Deutsche de la Mirta prize was awarded to the first aircraft that could fly, make the round trip from Park St. Cloud to the Eiffel Tower in less than 30 minutes, round trip. Santos Dumont's number 6 dirigible was the second attempt for Santos Dumont. Initially, Santos Dumont was told he was 40 seconds longer than the expectation set by the contest by the judge. After several umpire reviews, a deliberation from Congress, several Tea Party events, and the crowds threatening to overthrow the judge, Santos Dumont was awarded the prize a week later. And even in 1901, there were bad calls. In October 20th, 1922, over Dayton, Ohio, a loaning PW-12 of the United States Army Air Corps spirals out of control. The pilot, Lieutenant Ronald Harris, decides to abandon his plane and bails out. Harris's decision makes him the first successful person to parachute to the ground after bailing out of a stricken aircraft. First flights that occurred during the week of October 17th through October 23rd. The Northrop YB-49 Flying Wing Bomber first flew on October 21st, 1947, and the Bell UH-1D Iroquois, otherwise known as the Huey, October 22nd, 1956. And that's the way it was, October 7th through October 23rd.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, October 17th, 2010.
Well, g'day, folks, and welcome back to the Australian News Desk for episode 119 of the Airplane Geek Show. I'm Steve Vischer, and with me is Grant McHaren. G'day, mate.
Hey, mate, how are you going?
I tell you, I've been very busy this week, Grant, doing the new Australian pastime. You know what that is?
I don't know, Steve. What is the new Australian pastime?
Does this give you a hint?
Collecting cash registers.
No, indeed, it's collecting US currency, because this week, for the first time in, I don't know, 25-something years, the Australian dollar has reached parity with the US greenback.
What, you mean the US greenback is now the North Pacific peso?
It could be, yes.
Oh, man, if it's got parity with the South Pacific peso.
I'll tell you what, mate, that's disaster for our exporters here, because they like it when the Aussie dollar is as weak as possible against the greenback. But for those of us who like to buy audio equipment on eBay, well, it's great news.
Heaven! So I guess that you've got about 20 different auctions on watch at the moment?
Yes, oh, there's, I think there's another one. Oh. Hello, microphone.
Oh, dear. Well, let's see. What else could we talk about in addition to you gloating over the parity of the dollar? How about this one? Apparently, the United States Department of Transport blocking the Delta V alignment may actually go against the Open Skies Agreement of 2008. That's pretty interesting, isn't it?
That is interesting, mate. I mean, where is this ever going to end? It seems to be just a never-ending back-and-forth routine between the two governments, the regulators, the airlines. There just seems to be no end to it.
I don't know, mate. I sometimes think, much and all as you need governments for various regulations, the open market doesn't always work, because that's brought us so many disasters as well, he says, looking at Enron. But, yeah, I just don't know where the middle ground is on this one, and we'll just have to wait and see how it all falls apart. But just interesting that you've got the two regulators on both sides of the Pacific actually going up against what it all means and arguing with each other. Rather fun. But meanwhile, On the regulation front, we also find closer to home that Wellington Airport in New Zealand is not happy with the concept of Air New Zealand and Virgin Blue setting up a Trans-Tasman alliance. They think it will not do any good for fares. They think that it will actually help raise airfares. So not sure about following the money on that one, but that Wellington Airport has turned around and said they agree that with the ACCC that it shouldn't be allowed.
We were talking about that the other week, Grant, where, you know, either way, you know, if it becomes a monopoly, they're saying it, if it reduces competition, that it may have the effect of increasing fares. On the other hand, well, you know, they could always pull out of there and it would have the same effect. So
yeah, although if they do pull out, you may find someone like AirAsia or Tiger might decide to suddenly start flying the Tasman. And
not Tiger.
Well, you know.
You know, I think as long as the Kiwis insist on not beating us at cricket every tournament, I don't think we need to inflict Tiger Airways on them, do we, Grant?
Well, you could have a point there, Steve. But meanwhile, it's interesting to note that Jetstar are also getting into alliances. Qantas have gone up and said that Etihad and Virgin Alliance is not a good thing, and yet Jetstar is jumping into bed with American Airlines. Jetstar is going to carry American Airlines traffic within New Zealand. So you'll be able to book straight through from American Airlines through in New Zealand via Jetstar, all through the one booking and so on. So it's interesting that they were saying this kind of thing was bad, but now suddenly they're doing it themselves.
You know, it seems to be a bad thing if it's their competitor doing it, but all right if they're doing it. So I guess over there, the Kiwis are you know, doing the same sort of thing over there, and you know, they mightn't like some alliances coming up that are going to affect their business on one side, but on the other hand, they've got to be prudent business people, and they've got to go in there and sign other agreements that are good for their business. So really interesting times at the moment in this part of the world with all this sort of stuff going on.
It gets kind of kooky, and speaking of kooky, mate, apparently a guy smashed his car into one of the barriers at Adelaide Airport, climbed the security fence and ran onto the tarmac. People in the terminal got to see it all happening and got to see him being taken down by a few workers and some cops.
Yeah, here's an article that we see on the ABC News website talking about that. And just having a look at the picture here, what was he thinking, Grant? He's only driving a Toyota Camry.
Oh,
you think, mate, if he'd driving an F-100, he might have had a better shot at it.
Yeah.
Maybe a Kenworth.
Well, yeah, because those blocks are pretty big. So block one, car zero.
Yes, well, there you go. Not even a new Camry either.
Yeah, well, maybe if he was a military guy, he would have been able to figure it out. But, you know, even military guys have a bad run. And we find that here in Australia, the Defence Department has a list of projects of concern. For instance, the Wedgetail Airborne Early Warning System, that's been on the project of concern for quite a while, even though now it's pretty much delivering and going ahead. It's still being watched. And so too is the MRTT, the KC-30, the tanker, the A330-based tanker. That's on the watch list at the moment. But they just managed to get the third tanker up into the air. It's being constructed and it's been out for its proving flights at the moment. It came out of the Boeing Australia facility up north there.
Yeah, so good to see. And we know that tankers are something that makes all the guys over there at the Airplane Geek shudder. But it's nice to see that, although this project, as we've reported quite a while ago now, hasn't been without its flaws. They haven't been major problems by the sounds of things. You know, the aircraft returned to Spain, the two that we had returned to Spain for some more commissioning and testing and all that sort of thing a few months back. Grant, I'm not sure if those aircraft are back in Australia yet. Do you know?
Honestly, I'm not aware. I think they may actually still be over in Europe doing some testing, but definitely the third one came off the modification line up north in Australia and is now flying, doing its post-production flying.
Okay, well, that's about everything we have for you on this week's Australia Desk, Grant. I'll tell you what, I've got to get back to eBay.
Well, who am I to get in the way of a deal?
Yeah, Max, don't worry about that PR40. I think I've got it covered.
Oh, mate, it's that good, is it?
Yeah, so, well, you know, they're even talking about the Australian dollar going up to about $1.10.
Oh, mate, that'll be just like in the early 80s when it was possible to buy an American magazine at the American price, because that with the dollar to $1.10, yeah, that would pretty much cover the shipping as well.
Cool. I could buy some more copies of Mad Magazine. Excellent. Well, folks, I can't really concentrate on this. I'll catch you next week and while I'm paying off all these eBay bills. Until then, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran going, Steve, hello, Steve, look away from the computer.
Those guys just have to get out more. You know, they really do.
Well, Steve actually is. Steve is going to be featured on a streaming internet program in a couple days. This is a program produced by Dan Golden, who used to be an executive producer over at Leo Laporte's Twit Network. And he has a show called Hey, as in H-E-Y. And Steve is going to be on the show Tuesday, October 19th. He'll be on 8 p.m. Pacific, which is 11 p.m. Eastern Time or 3 a.m. GMT. So you can listen to Steve, and you can also call into the show live. And to find that, it's over at www.hey.com/live. And I suspect you'll be able to view that afterwards as well. So great to Steve for getting himself on that program.
Yeah, wow. So he really is getting out more.
He absolutely is, yeah.
Wow.
Fantastic. Moving on to some listener mail. We got a letter from Nathan. He's the 15-year-old listener. He says that he's been enjoying the podcast since episode 86. In December, he's going to Vietnam and Thailand for vacation. He's very excited about the flying part. I would be too. He has some questions. He's going to be flying on a number of aircraft, 747-400, a 777-300, and an A330. He has a flight from Dallas-Fort Worth to Incheon, South Korea. It's a 15-hour flight. And Nathan writes, I was wondering if you have any tips on how to get my way up to a better seat with more legroom or maybe into business class. That's a tough one. Dan, have you got any advice for Nathan?
It's a tough one because it's hard to recommend a specific seat. I mean, I send them over to SeatGuru because that's the best site for this stuff.
Yeah,
well, SeatGuru or SeatExpert, I believe, is another one.
Those are the two that I use.
But the issue is I wasn't able to find online which configuration, as Korean seems to have four versions of the 7-4 flying and passenger service, one of which is a combi, which I don't think they fly at DFW.
No, they've got full-blown cargo service to DFW, so I doubt they fly the combi.
Yeah, so that was the best I could do. And I mean, obviously, you can upgrade with miles, but I'm not sure. You might want to check at the airport. I really couldn't find a whole lot. I was kind of surprised.
What I'm wondering is that when did he say he's going to be flying this?
In December.
In December, because they Koreans moving their slowly retiring their 744 fleet and replacing them with 777-300ERs.
Okay.
So I don't know if he'll end up on one of those or still on the 744.
Ah, interesting.
I mean, it's scheduled, but that doesn't mean everything.
Yeah.
Could be uncertain.
I would definitely defer to SeatGuru and SeatExpert. And in terms of figuring out the configuration, I would another wonderful little website is Expert Flyer.
Okay.
And good. That pretty much gives you all the seat information that the airline supplies travel agent.
Now, but I believe that's paid, right?
You can get like a 5 or 6 day, oh, like a 1 week preview for free.
Okay.
We got another letter from David. David wrote in. He really enjoys the podcast. He found it about a month ago. He's catching up slowly. He mentions he's a lifelong aerospace fan, but it's just been a hobby, not a profession. Although he now notes that he has an opportunity to work for regional elite airline services as a cross-utilized agent. He says at a very busy Class 2 station where they outbid at ASA. But he's says he's read nothing positive about regional elite, and the pay, quite frankly, sucks. He says, I don't really care about non-revving either, as my sweetie is disabled and goes through hell at airports. Then there's the animosity I've heard about between flight crews and rampers. From what my research tells me, I guess being a professional ramper went out when deregulation came in. Since you guys are pros, I'd be interested in your opinion. And I think, Rob, you had a little bit of opinion on this topic for David, didn't you?
Well, I asked him why he'd want to work for a company that had such a terrible reputation. But and I know Dan came up with a comment, too, about the rampers. And I mean, when I used to fly for Midway, we loved our ramp people. Mm. I mean, they were great. I don't honestly know a whole lot of the pilots, at least that I know, that have been that have had terrible interactions with their ramp people. I mean, I guess once in a while, but I'd like to hear more about that kind of a issue from any pilots that are out there listening. But
yeah. I mean, this is complete speculation. First, I really have heard nothing about the company, so I can't say anything about that. The only thing I can think of animosity between rampers and pilots. First, obviously, it's probably going to vary by pilot. The only thing I can think of, just because I don't know what station is, but because there are some stations that were probably served by mainline employees at one point and are now contracted out. I mean, the whole, not just Ramper period. I mean, contracted labor, you know, isn't always the most popular. I mean, outsourcing is always a touchy topic.
Yeah, sure.
With airline
employees.
That's
a good point. Good point.
Okay. Finally, one more from Alex in China. Alex writes something that may interest you. Some Japanese air controllers let some students give directions to pilots. Three of them have been reprimanded by the Japanese Transport Ministry. I just wonder what is going on with these ridiculous and crazy people who run these ministries. Education is my brief, he says, and I support hands-on as part of the process. When I learnt to fly in Australia in the mid-80s, a group of us went to the tower at Sydney Kingsford Smith International Airport in Sydney. We had no problems and were welcome. Now it seems that if you want to learn something, you have to be employed by the company or organization. So Alex is asking, what is it with the times? Are we all too scared to allow responsibility by those who do the work? Do we have to have some sort of ministerial approval before professionals or for professionals to conduct these field trips, and why?
Well, was the issue just the fact that they were there, or that they were actually, the sense I get from them, they were actually doing some direction?
Yeah, I think that they were maybe giving some direction to the pilots.
But if they're traffic control students who have, you know, so who know what's going on, as long as, obviously I don't know the situation, I'd have to think that as long as the professional controllers were right there, I mean...
Yeah,
like maybe this situation, if they're like air traffic control students, is slightly more defensible than, say, the JFK.
Yeah, I was thinking the JFK incident comes to mind.
Sure. You know, I think that we're just living in times now that we're risk adverse. Everyone's afraid of liability. No one wants to be accused of making some decisions that others would consider bad. And so we've kind of pulled back in a lot of ways. And I think Alex is making an interesting point that, at least with regard to introducing young folks to aviation, it can have sort of a negative effect. And it's kind of too bad, but gee, you know, it's kind of the time we're in, I think.
The thing that I keep thinking is that I don't think you'll find a group of people who are more committed to aviation safety than air traffic controllers.
Yeah, good point.
Because that's a really high stress job, it's not like they get paid particularly well. You really have to do it because you're committed to it and you want to be there and you want to do it. And so this whole notion that these people who by their very definition of their job are highly committed to aviation safety and have to be, are just going to sort of throw that away to let either their kid or a bunch of students compromise that, I think it's kind of ludicrous.
Hmm. Yeah, I kind of agree. I mean, however, I would take exception with one. Actually, these days, they're pretty decently paid when they work. They still work for FAA. But it is a stress, crazy, crazy job. I mean, hell, look what it did to me.
Yeah.
And only after years of therapy, you can now talk to us.
That's right.
And as people say, you know what? That does explain a lot.
It does. All right, I think that'll do it for this show.
Oh, my God, I hope so.
I know, this has been a long one. I'd like to thank you all for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. This coming week, we have the NBAA convention. Rob is going to be there, right, Rob?
I'm already here.
You're already there in Atlanta.
Yeah, that's what I'm in Atlanta for. Hey, I had fun. It's going to be a good show. We've got a lot of things happening. Had a chance to fly an airplane. The Dassault people were nice enough to let me fly their 900LX for a couple hours yesterday.
Nice.
And we have some new Piper jet, single-engine jet news. The new Gulfstream is making news. There's going to be a couple of big orders. Oh, it's going to be some good stuff here, I think.
Terrific. And any kind of events during the week that you're looking forward to?
Well, we have a social media event on Wednesday. We've got a big tweet up at Signature Flight Support on Tuesday. And there's a light aircraft business show, which is trying to, you know, it's AOPA and NBAA working together to try to bring more people to the NBAA show that use, say, Cirrus and that category of aircraft for business. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be a pretty good show this year.
Good. Well,
but Rob, who's really get to the point? Who's the demo team for the Business Jet Association?
The demo team.
I mean, come on. Don't they put up six like G650s and do loops rolls? And I mean, where's the exciting stuff?
Yeah, well, you know, that's actually kind of a good point. And a couple of the folks that we've had on the show are going to be here. Mary Kirby's going to be here, you know, Runway Girl. We're going to have Binet Wilson, Avweek Binet. We have Flight Blogger.
Refer to her properly. She is the queen.
No, the goddess.
The goddess.
Social media goddess. We have to call her social media goddess.
All right, very good. We'll have more about the convention next week. Again, we'd like to thank our guest, Rafael Marquez, for joining us. You can find his site at www.iloveplanes.com. Be sure to check out Steve Vischer and Grant McCarron at the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast. And of course, as I mentioned previously, listen to Steve live on the Hey Talk Show. That's at www.hey.com/live. All right, now for the self-promotion section of the show. Dan Webb, where can people find you online?
Okay, before I say that, two things. Number one, Mr. Vanderhoof, I'm strong enough emotionally to say this. Let's go Mets. number two, just to add something to last week, when we were talking about the Washington National slots, I neglected to mention one applicant, which is very interesting. Sun Country applying for service to Lansing. Michigan from Washington, yes. But a one stop through Minneapolis. I'm hoping to find. I just wanted to pop it in there. Hopefully, I'll finally be blogging about this. As to where you can find me online, find me on Twitter, Dan Webbage, and you can find me on my blog, thingsinthesky.com.
Very good. And Rob Mark.
Well, of course, this week Jetwine will be down at NBAA, and we'll be tweeting all over the place with our buddies at AIN Online. And of course, I'm going to be listening to Hey, what is it? Hey what?
.com.
Hey dot. It's just Hey dot com.
It's just Hey HEY.com.
Hey dot com. Unless, of course, I get back to Wisconsin early, because then, of course, there would be yaheydare.com. Okay.
Okay.
Sorry.
And David Vanderhoof, where can people find you online?
Oh, I can be found at my blog, whatjustflewby.com, or you can find me on Twitter, marveling and ogling at my co-hosts, Rob and Dan, as they tweet frantically through the week at dmvanderhoof.com.
All right. And Gavin Werbeloff, where can people find you online?
I can be found on Twitter at travel_buddha.com. That's BUDDHA.
Very good. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me at 30,000feet.com or on Twitter at Max Flight. Be sure to see airplanegeeks.com for show notes and listener comments. Buy a t-shirt, help support the cause. You can also follow us on Twitter at airplanegeeks. If you'd like to send us email, that's thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. You can also leave us a voicemail.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS01.
All right. Join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everyone.
Good night.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. Bye.
Everybody ready?
Oh, that's right. We don't need me to sing that because we play that, don't we?
And this is Gavin. Have you seen any of the videos from this?
No, I haven't.
Nor I.
Oh.
Have you, Max? Neither.
No, I've been away.
So we might as well just cut this piece of news right out of the story, right?
If you want to hang around, that's fine.
Okay.
Otherwise, we'll keep going.
Because otherwise, if you hang around, that means Dan has to go. Yeah. I'm just kidding, Dan. Oh, come on.
Airplane Geek Podcast Survivor. The tribe has spoken.
That's right. Yeah.
Well said. Please, Raphael, how old are you? No, you can't. You don't tell us that, but you're
I'll be 40 in December.
Huh.
So, yeah.
I can't even remember when I was 40. I can't even remember when I was 50. In fact, I can't. Well,
You want to stop there. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll just stop.
Rob, usually I'm there to make an age comment, but you just took care of it yourself this week. Thank you.
I know.
I have a very quick question for you, sir, based on your title. Your title would imply there is a unofficial Airplane Geeks historian, and I would like to meet him.
I talk to Max.
I don't know. We just always called David the official Airplane Geeks historian.
Dan, are you studying for the LSAT or something?
No, though in a few months I am going to start looking at the CFA.
That whole line of thought is something that would be very indicative of too much time doing logic games.
CFA?
The Chartered Financial Analyst Certification. And I can't take it for a while because I think you have to take the first exam within 6 months of graduation, but I might as well start early.
Chartered or certified?
Chartered.
Chartered. That just sounds odd. Speaking of sounding odd...
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australian News Desk.
Yeah, I reckon just pull them all out and let them all crash and burn. That's not a good thing to say about an airline, is it?
Let us not say that.
Okay, we'll cut that bit. Steve, don't spend the donations on the... Oh!
We got a letter from Nathan. Nathan is a 15-year-old.
We got a litter from Nathan?
Is that what I said?
It's not like you said we've got a litter.
As in trash or like some...
I don't know.
Someone received like a basket of cats on their doorstep?
Yeah.
We got a litter. Yeah.
Sorry. Okay. I'm sorry. That was cruel.